This is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome all of you to our webinar today, New Horizons in the Prevention of Type 1 and Type 2 Diabetes. Normally when we think about prevention, we think, oh, we can prevent type 2, but there's been some terrific research out there that says not only can we really make a difference with type 2, but also we're learning so much about the pathophysiology and the biochemistry and the genetics of type 1. There's a lot of hope that maybe we can prevent type 1 during our lifetime. So I'm really hoping to live long enough that I see that. That would be terrific. For more information, I really encourage you to visit our website. We have a lot of great resources, articles, pocket cards. We have a whole library. We have a newsletter. And our website is posted here, diabetesed.net. And we also have a whole online university. And the online university offers online courses where you can earn CEs. And the great thing about our online university is you can just, you know, choose the courses you want, listen from any computer, and then when you complete the course, you get your CE certificate. So for a lot of us who live in more rural areas and traveling is really a cost factor, I think this offers a really nice solution. And we're always expanding our library of online courses to make sure we meet your needs. So with that in mind, let's get started. So to hear this presentation, as I'm sure you figured out, you just need to turn on your computer or you can listen via your phone. And if you're having any technical difficulties, it's kind of hard to fix it on the fly, but be reassured that we'll be posting this recorded version and archiving it so you can listen anytime. And we'll send you the link to the recorded version after this webinar is completed. It takes about an hour or two to package it up and send it out, but we will make sure to do that. As far as questions, I want to keep this as interactive as possible, so we'll try and answer as we go along. But what I generally do at the very end, if I haven't answered your question, I kind of linger, turn off the recording button, and then that's an opportunity for you all to ask the questions, and we can have a nice little meeting afterward if you can stay. I know you're all super busy, so I really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to join us. As far as the handout, I sent you an email with a link to the handout, but just in case you didn't get a chance to open that up, all you have to do is go to our website, diabetesed.net, and then there's a resources tab on the right side. Click that. Go to free webinars. It's a drop down. And then choose a New Horizons webinar. And on that page, you will be able to see the PDF of the PowerPoint. And you can just click that and print it out or just take a look at it either way. So, if you have any questions on that, let me know, and I'll be happy to help you after the web clinic. We're really excited, speaking of our online university, to offer our attendees a great discount. We have 19 online courses currently available for a total of 25 CEs, and all of our CEs can be utilized towards your CDE, your RN, RD, and other health care professionals can utilize these CEs. For this entire package, it's usually $199. But if you want, we're giving a $30 discount, so only $169. And all you have to do when you're going to purchase it is enter the coupon code ALMOND. It's our way of saying thank you to you for joining us today and for being a part of this movement to help people with diabetes live better lives and to help us prevent diabetes in the future. So what are we going to talk about today? Wow, we've got a lot of great stuff to cover. I have 60 slides and probably not enough time, but it's okay because I'm just like, all this stuff is so important. I've got to get it in there. So we'll move quickly through these, and if we have, you know, questions at the end, I'll be happy to stay. But we're going to look at the new findings in prevention, focus on type 2 first, and then focus on type 1. And interestingly enough, we're going to wrap up with a topic, one of my favorite topics, happiness. A lot of our people with diabetes really struggle with living with diabetes every day, and we know 35% of people with diabetes live with depression. So as educators and you know, people who are working one-on-one with people living with diabetes, are there some tools that we can offer them to live more successfully and happily and healthfully with their diabetes? So before I go to my next slide, I'm going to go ahead and launch a poll, and it's going to ask this question. According to the CDC, what best describes the future epidemic of diabetes? And all you have to do is click on one of those answers that you think represents what the future of diabetes looks like. The thing I do love about technology are these polls, because I can go ahead and see, you know, get some responses from you and interact. It's a pretty great option in these webinars for me. Great tool. All right. Well, most of you have voted, so just take a second, and I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share with you what you all said. And most of you chose the right answer. And it is true that 1 in 3 people will have diabetes type 2 by the year 2050, or 35%. That's a pretty shocking statistic. If you already think about Medicare dollars, 30% of Medicare dollars go to treat diabetes right now. And right now, our numbers are much lower in the prevalence of diabetes. So how will we afford this in the year 2050? And how will it impact our communities and our quality of life? Is something I think about a lot. Here's my two little boys, Robert, he's my 12-year-old, and Jackson, he's my 9-year-old. They don't usually dress like this. I just want to reassure you. They were going to go to a piano recital. But by the time they're 50, 1 in 3 of their friends, relatives, college buddies, coworkers will have diabetes. That's hard to believe. Right now, only about 1 in 10 Americans have diabetes, or about 8.3%. So that's a huge increase. The other thing I worry about a lot is that 79 million people have prediabetes. So these are people with abnormal blood sugar levels running fasting 100 to 125. That's about 30% of Americans right now running around with hyperglycemia. So these people we know are walking toward diabetes. And what can we do to help slow down this epidemic? We'll be talking about that. World Diabetes Day is in November, so just to kind of put a seed out there to think, what could I do in my community, in my facility, in my family to help get the word out about World Diabetes Day and raise recognition of it? And I love this poster. It's from the International Diabetes Federation, and their website's down here, worlddiabetesday.org. And look what it says, the right education for all. And this picture, I was looking at it very carefully the other day, and of course it looks at all the self-care skills you need to get out there and move and exercise. But look at the educator where she's sitting. She's not standing and towering above people or lecturing at them. She's sitting down and showing them about healthy food. So I really see this as, you know, saying, we're in this together. We're a team. We've got to take action now to protect our kids for the future. And this is the right environment for all. So certainly the World Diabetes Federation and the international community has recognized it's not just about education. It's about access to healthy food, access to safe places to exercise, making sure our kids are educated, because we know poverty and diabetes go hand in hand. We know lack of education increases people's risk for poverty and then diabetes and other chronic illnesses. As a matter of fact, in the world right now, there's more chronic illnesses than infectious disease. So we're really having to look at changing our public health model and dealing more with chronic illness, and how do we combat that? The other thing I want to talk about for a moment is our kids. And yes, adults are getting more type 2 diabetes, but if you look at the Today 2 trial, and this was recently released, some of the initial data, there's been a 7-fold increase in type 2 in our kids since 1990. And look at this, 1 in 6 kids are overweight, about 20% are overweight, and even there's an additional amount that are obese, and many of these overweight kids already have prediabetes, so they're marching toward diabetes. We have about 4,000 new cases annually of type 2 in kids, but the highest risk children are very obese, minority female, low socioeconomic status with limited education. So again, this is a combination of genetics and environment and education. We really need to think about diabetes from a broader perspective. And so whatever setting you work in, and I was looking at where you all work, and many of you are working in the public health setting, health education setting, just whatever you can do in your communities to help raise this awareness. And this is interesting from the Today's trial, what they stated was environmental changes are urgently needed. Environmental changes. Stepping toward a healthier generation. So now there's, you know, all this information out there for educators to reach out and saying, let's pass on health to the next generation. Let's pass on a legacy of health to our kids. The other thing I want to mention is this zip code issue, and that is, why should zip code determine life expectancy? I was, you know, disembarking from a plane in Sacramento Airport, and I saw this poster, and I was just struck by it. Because it says, if you live in Stockton, and for those of you who are not familiar with Stockton, it's a rough area. It's a lower socioeconomic status, not many resources. The life expectancy is 73. But if you live in Irvine, which is a very affluent community, you can expect to live till 88. That's a 15-year discrepancy in the same state. And so we're trying to think, where are these health disparities? What's happening environmentally and from health resources and education resources? And that, why, you know, why is the life expectancy so varied based on your geographic location? And I would really encourage you to look up your zip code at www.measureofamerica.org. This is for across the entire United States. You can type in your zip code and see your average life expectancy of your population, and also look to see if you're at your demographic mix-up and your income disparities and how much people make on average. It's very eye-opening. And so as I think as we move forward in this conversation, this is going to have to be a big part of what we discuss. And so you could say to me, well, Bev, you know, maybe it's McDonald's fault that our kids are getting heavier. As a matter of fact, I have a poll. What do you all think is contributing to the increased risk of type 2 diabetes? And you can actually choose more than one of these. Yeah. Thank you for voting. I appreciate it. Okay, we'll take a few more seconds. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with all of you. So many of you said junk food, lack of exercise, changes in gut bacteria, environment, and all of the above. So I really agree with you that all of the above is probably the best answer. And, you know, look at this slide. It's one of my favorite slides. I use it probably in every talk I do because it's so instructive in that if you think about McDonald's, when I was a little girl, going to McDonald's was a big deal. We didn't have a lot of money, and you know, going out to eat was a real luxury. But anyways, when we went to McDonald's, we would get a soda, maybe fries, and a hamburger. And that's 627 calories, 19 grams of fat. So it's not exactly healthy, but it's about one-third of my daily caloric needs, so it's not wildly, you know, high calorically dense. But you look at this supersized meal, which many people order now, and this is 1,800 calories. It's three times the amount of calories, but look at the fat difference. This is 19 grams of fat. This is 84 grams of fat. So this is almost a quintupling of the grams of fat. I mean, it's just shocking. And this is not the good kind of fat that's, you know, has all these healthy fat. It's the saturated fat that clogs up your vessels. So I think it's a lot about education for our families. And the other thing I want to say is many of our people maybe have limited income. They can't afford to, you know, get healthy foods in their mind, and they're going to fast food and locations. So we can help them make better choices at fast food places. So I always ask patients, tell me what you're usually eating there. Let's see if we can healthy it up a little bit. And so we say, well, let's, instead of getting a soda, that would be my first thing. Let's try and get iced tea or water or another, you know, beverage. If it's a kid, let's maybe substitute for milk. And then can you not eat the French fries, or can you just eat five French fries and toss the rest? So we're going to do a lot of negotiation. I mean, you know, a hamburger is not horrible. You have the two buns and the meat, and then you have the cheese. There's actually some vegetables involved, but light on the sauce and hold the cheese. So it's gradual baby steps for a lot of our patients who are really eating out a lot. Can they make a few changes, and that will definitely help. But you can look at this graph and see, is your child overweight? And there is, over the past, you know, 20 to 30 years, a tremendous increase in the weight of our kids. And so we get back to Dr. Frieden. Now, Dr. Frieden's from the Center for Disease Control. And I was at a conference, and I heard this quote from him. And I've actually, you know, read a lot of his speeches and talks, and he talks about this a lot actually, that we really need to make changes as a society to reduce the prevalence of obesity, because it's going to require community action. It's not just one-on-one education, which as a diabetes educator, I do a lot of one-on-one education, and I love it. I love talking to patients, but it's bigger than that. We're going to need to take community action. And actually, I have here the word obesity, but I would say the only way to decrease the prevalence of diabetes and obesity, is through community action. So here's the deal. I'm kind of thinking about diabetes from a public health perspective. We know that 66% of our people are obese or overweight. The rates of gestational diabetes are dramatically increasing. And the thing about gestational diabetes, if a woman has gestational diabetes and during her pregnancy, her children are more likely to get diabetes. And the woman has a 50% chance of getting diabetes within 5 years of delivery. So can we look backward and help women as they move into pregnancy be in the healthiest state possible? Because we know that you can help people prevent gestational diabetes too. So we'll take a look at that. And we know our kids are overweight or obese. So here's a really nice calendar or poster you could put in your office. It's choosehealthla.com. Choose less, weigh less. So, you know, just by making this simple change in what you're eating, you cut your calories in half. I'd like to ask you all another question. How many teaspoons of sugar does the average American consume a day? Let's take a guess. If you're noticing this handout looks different than the handout, maybe you downloaded it yesterday. It is. Of course, I added some new slides. So this version of the handout is on my website now, where you can download the most recent version. So you know how with speakers are. We get excited about certain topics, and we add slides in last minute. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share with what you all said. So you, none of you chose 6 to 8 teaspoons. A few of you chose 10 teaspoons. Half of you said 12 to 16, and the other half chose 22 teaspoons. Well, believe it or not, the right answer is 22 teaspoons a day. That's what our average American is eating. And you know what? They don't know they're eating all that sugar because it's hidden in the food. It's added to the foods. And our patients and our family members, they don't know how to read labels to see that that sugar that's infiltrating all of our food sources. And, you know, you'll hear people talk about sugar addiction, but I was, you know, thinking about this too. Is it time to tax junk food? This was a big topic a few months ago. And, you know, to help people change the way they eat. And actually, there's some legislation right now in California to put a warning label on sodas saying, warning, sodas can increase your risk of obesity and diabetes, which I think is very interesting. And it's looking like it's going to pass through the legislation. One soda has 12 teaspoons of sugar. Sorry, that's a mistake right there. On average, one person consumes 40 gallons of soda a year. Okay, that's shocking. And the new ADA guidelines, now the American Diabetes Association publishes their standards of care every year, and they're very conservative. But they, in their guidelines, now recommended limit sodas and beverages with sugar and high fructose corn syrup, otherwise known as HFCS. They can contribute to visceral adiposity and increased risk of diabetes. And so we're getting these messages from all different places, and yet we're still struggling with all this sugar issue. So I want to ask you all another question. How do you feel, or what do you think? Should there be a tax on sugary beverages? Do you support that? And your response is completely confidential, so you can just answer honestly. It's totally fine. All right. Thank you very much for voting. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share your answers. So 63% of you said, yeah, I think we should have a tax on sugary beverages. 30%, no, don't want to go there. and 8% of you aren't sure. And this is a very interesting debate because now we're entering into public health and legislation, and we're saying to people, you know, you really need to pay a tax if you drink more sugar. And I do want to mention something about the cigarette tax. About 30 years ago, there was a huge cigarette tax imposed, and cigarettes are wildly expensive now. And if you look at the cigarette and the smoking stats, they have dropped dramatically. Like over the past 30 years, they have dropped over 40%. So the cigarette tax was very effective in changing people's behavior. I just want to put that out there as we're moving forward to think, how could we combat this epidemic of diabetes and obesity? Is there things we can do through legislation that don't impinge on people's rights, but yet, you know, improve health of our population? So I know many of you are passionate about that either way. And so I was just wanted to talk about our kids, because truly, and Michelle Obama and the Let's Move campaign has brought this to the forefront. Let's keep our kids at a healthy weight during childhood. So that way, when they move into adulthood, they're not overweight or obese. Because as I've mentioned, if they're overweight and as they move into adulthood, they're more likely to be overweight or obese adults. And especially for women, if they move into pregnancy being overweight or obese, they're more likely to get gestational diabetes. And then that cycle continues. So how can we help our kids stay healthy? And I've listed some environmental ideas here and then some lifestyle ideas, you know, really helping our kids to limit screen time, get out, get active, healthy snacks, limiting junk food, and really encouraging fruits and vegetables. And there's a lot of education in that direction. And actually, I do have good news that the rate of childhood obesity has plateaued. Our kids aren't getting any heavier. We've seemed to have stopped that trend from going up. So there's hope. We know that as a community, if we reach out to our kids and share this information and provide resources, we're more likely to succeed. And when I talk to my patients, you know, a lot of times I'll talk about the plate method and healthy eating, but my main message is move toward the tomato. So I kind of think about food on a health continuum. And of course, foods from the earth and non-packaged foods are the healthiest. Whereas you move toward the Twinkie and the fast food, you know, it's just full of, I don't even know if I would call Twinkie food, to be honest with you. I mean, there's a lot of chemicals and sugar and fat. And so we want our patients to benefit from the variety of fruits and vegetables and all the different colors of the rainbow, nuts and so forth. And then I do want to say something about coffee, that this is good news for you coffee drinkers out there, that drinking 2 cups of coffee a day seems to decrease your risk of getting diabetes. So there's something really wonderful in that cocoa bean. And also, smoking cigarettes increases the risk of diabetes by 30%. That came out with a new Surgeon General warning, so just an FYI. So when I talk to my patients, I'm always trying to steer away from don't eat these foods, you know, avoid this food, because they're already struggling with diabetes and what can I eat? And I give them this little handout, which is 10 superfoods to enjoy. And they're like, really? I can eat all these foods? I'm like, yes, they're great. Enjoy them. Of course, we talk about portion control, but these are foods that were posted on the American Diabetes Association, and they're really just have so many benefits from a fiber, vitamins, nutrient perspective, and maybe they even help prevent inflammation, and inflammation, especially of the intestines, can increase risk of expression of disease. So my patients are like, I can have sweet potatoes and berries. They are so happy when I show them this list. I do want to point out on this, there is no, besides fish, meat isn't listed on here. And, you know, fat-free milk and yogurt is, but cheeses aren't listed on here either. So a lot of our patients, that's one of an area they get a lot of their calories from. And sometimes if my patients are struggling with weight and diabetes, I do discuss, you know, intake of animal foods and kind of negotiate. Could you just have a meat-free meal once a day? I'm sorry, once a week. And sometimes they're willing to just try that. And that is really beneficial from a calorie perspective and also maybe from an inflammation perspective. So here's a great stat. I love this. This is from the Diabetes Prevention Program, the CDC-led initiative, which showed that every 2.2 pounds of weight loss, if you don't have diabetes, so if you don't have it, reduces your risk of type 2 by 13%. And so I think the message here is helping our people eat healthier foods, get to a better weight, and knowing that any weight loss makes a difference. You can see here 2.2 pounds, which is really, it's, you know, achievable for most people, reduces the risk of type 2 by 13%. And I would have to say I've really changed my focus now with people with prediabetes and diabetes, that weight loss has really been shown to protect your beta cells. And so I talk about healthy eating, but we really discuss strategies to lose that weight. So we've talked about environmental issues, and we've talked about, you know, food intake and sugar and calories and superfoods. But with the epidemic of type 2, I like to say maybe it's just more than that. Maybe that's just one piece of the puzzle. And we need to look beyond the obvious with type 2 diabetes, because why are so many people getting it? And so I'd like to discuss some other factors with you that might be influencing that. And I want to ask you one more question. Which two best describe our relationship to our gut bacteria? Which two of the following answers best describe our relationship to our gut bacteria? And you may be asking, why is she talking about gut bacteria during a diabetes lecture? And the truth is, there's some serious magic happening in your 1 mile of intestines that are helping prevent disease and protect us against diabetes. It's pretty amazing stuff. Okay, thank you so much for voting, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and just share with what you all said. And some of you said less is better, and 60% said the more diverse is better, and foods rich in fiber improve gut bacteria. Those are both correct answers, that we need gut bacteria. We have a symbiotic relationship with them, and that is since the beginning of mankind, we have interacted with bacteria in our environment, and bacteria are very essential to our normal functioning. So we'll look at this through the microbiome project in a few slides down the road here, looking at our relationship with the bacteria that live in our environment and how changes in our environment have changed our relationship with our bacteria. So let's just think about obesity. Are there other factors? We've talked about, does calories in versus calories out? Is an energy out? Is that the only thing influencing it? Well, interestingly enough, not only humans are gaining weight globally, but animals are getting heavier too. And these are not just the domestic kind. Animals in the wild are weighing more. And the researchers are trying to figure out why. Why are animals getting heavier? And they don't necessarily have increased access to food. And so we're wondering, is there some change in the environment? And they talk about interesting things like sleep deprivation. You know, now that we're so well lit, and it doesn't, you know, most communities don't get completely dark anymore. And so it's maybe changing our circadian rhythm. Sleep deprivation. What about air conditioning? What does air conditioning have to do with obesity? Well, now we don't require as many calories to regulate our temperature. We're living in controlled environments. So this lack of having to use extra energy to get cooler or warm up maybe is contributing to it. We don't really know. So, and all these other factors might be contributing. So I think what we need to do is be excellent scientists and look beyond the obvious and wonder what else is causing us to get heavy. And the Human Microbiome Project is really doing that. Because if you think about our cells in our human body, bacterial cells outnumber our human cells 10 to 1. For every one human cell, there's 10 bacterial cells doing work for us, protecting us against bad bacteria, helping us digest food, helping us to do 100,000 other enzymatic, you know, actions in our body. And so what they're actually doing with this Human Microbiome Project, you heard of the Genome Project mapping our whole DNA sequence. Well, they completed that. So they're like, well, let's go on to a new thing. Now they're trying to map every single bacteria that lives on our body. It's going to take a really long time. So let's just first hit on our bacteria in our intestines and look at the relationship between our gut bacteria and our body weight and gut bacteria and our health and expression of type 1 and type 2, and then we'll also talk a little bit about gut hormones. But if we kind of really drill down and look in the intestines, you'll see that there's millions and millions of little bacteria, bacterial inhabitants, shown here in green, in the folds of our intestine. They're helping us utilize calories. They're helping us, fight against invaders. Bad things come down the track. They're, making sure that they're eliminated. There's like battles going on in your intestine right now. And so normal gut bacteria, if we look at, and this is actually an electron micrograph of bacteria, which an artist reinterpreted, which I think is really amazing. So you can look at that picture and see the diversity of bacteria in our intestine and imagine, all the functions that they serve us. But the bacteria in your intestine are collected over a lifetime, and I think this is a really important point. And it's environmental exposure. And I'll tell you where it actually does start. It starts with your birth. So if you're delivered vaginally or C-section, you have different bacteria that initially inhabited your intestine. So vaginal delivery babies actually tend to have a better array of gut bacteria. As they come out through the canal, they accumulate a different set, and they actually, it seems to be better than C-section as far as setting up the intestines for a healthier and more diverse situation. So that's the first place, and now you breast or bottle fed. So breastfed babies have a lot healthier microbe in their intestines versus bottle fed. And that's why we keep talking over and over again about the importance of breastfeeding, because those intestines early on are very sensitive and they really don't want outside influences initially, at least for the first 6 months. And so breastfeeding exclusively for the first 6 months is what's recommended. And that's in part, it helps that diversity and the safety of the intestines. And then you have types of foods consumed. So what if the parents are eating fresh fruits and vegetables? Well, those have a wide diversity of bacteria. But what if the parents are eating more fast food or foods that come in packaging like Twinkies and chips and pretzels? Those are sterile, and they may not have that variety of bacteria that contribute to a healthy situation. If you look at a kid's, intestinal bacteria versus the parents, there's a lot of similarities. So we know there's a lot of factors influencing this. And so could we help our kids get the best set of gut bacteria from the get-go is what we're really trying to do. Now, the major groups of intestinal bacteria is a balancing act. The major groups are the Firmicutes and the Bacteroides. Plus, there's thousands and thousands of others. But we know from looking at all kinds of studies that the more diverse the gut bacteria, the better. It's more protective. But I do want to look at weight first. So interestingly enough, when they look at leaner people and their gut bacteria, leaner people have more bacterial diversity and more of the type called Bacteroides. Now, as it turns out, Bacteroides are gut bacteria that are less efficient at converting food to calories. Now, our heavier people have more of the Firmicute type of bacteria, and these gut bacteria are very efficient at calorie extraction. So you can imagine in the past when we were more nomadic and we didn't have as much access to food, these bacteria might have been life-saving, where that if you don't eat that often, you don't have much access to food, you don't know when your next meal is going to come, these bacteria extract every single ounce of energy. That maybe was a benefit of the past. It no longer is a benefit of man in the current situation because of our easy access to food, especially high-calorie food. And so, if you think about environmental genetics and how we've changed over time, the things that used to help us in the past when we lived differently aren't helping us currently in the future, and our genetics haven't caught up to the way we live now, and that's why we might be seeing more obesity from an environmental and genetic perspective. The thing I always talk about in my classes, too, is this whole thing about visceral fat, and when we gain weight and when we have extra abdominal fat, the problem is it's actually getting into the viscera or the abdominal cavity. If you look at this picture on the right with the extra abdominal fat, it's not just subcutaneous. Yeah, there's a lot of subcutaneous fat there, but that fat is lining all of the intestines. It's lining the liver. It's lining the pancreas. And this is not good fat. This is yellow, sticky fat that actually releases cytokines and chemicals that cause more inflammation. So the good news for patients, I always say, if you just lose 1 or 2 pounds, half of that weight is lost from that visceral fat, or you can call it belly fat. And that's good news, because every pound lost from visceral fat decreases insulin resistance and decreases your blood sugars. So all your work at weight loss pays off. But you can see here, just looking at this picture, why we're having so much problems with fatty liver disease. So people who are overweight or obese, they store extra fat in their hepatocytes. So their hepatocytes are just full of fat. And this fatty liver disease can lead to cirrhosis and liver cancer. And our patients with diabetes are at particular risk. And so when we think about weight loss, we're thinking about reducing visceral adiposity. We're thinking about increasing insulin sensitivity and really helping our patients protect those beta cells. The other thing I mentioned earlier was fatty foods. So there's been a lot of research lately that when people eat high-fat foods, saturated fat, and also meat seems to also do this, it appears to trigger a passage of bacterial endotoxins through the intestinal wall. So this frequent exposure to fat or fat-containing foods seems to increase the levels of inflammatory cytokines and triglyceride levels. And it seems to be worse if patients eat or people eat frequent fatty meals throughout the day. There's more endotoxins out there. And so I would also say to you that the intestines are an endocrine organ, and that is the intestines are constantly interacting with the rest of the body. They're releasing all kinds of mediators, chemicals, cytokines that increase or decrease inflammation in the blood vessels. And so I think, you know, as we talk to our patients or think about this, what we put into what we eat really does have an impact on different disease states. The other thing I think is really interesting is looking at bacteria as a gut culprit. Helicobacter pylori infection doubled the risk of diabetes among Latinos. So what they did in this study is they looked at over almost 2,000 Latino men, and they evaluated them to see if they were infected with H. pylori at the beginning of the study and other bacterial infections. And then at the end of the study, after 10 years, they determined, were any of these groups at higher risk of expressing diabetes? And as it turned out, those who were seropositive at the beginning for H. pylori were twice as likely to develop diabetes, almost 3 times more likely. And it was also associated with a higher BMI. So different bacteria might be influencing our risk of diabetes and might be associated with higher risk of BMI too, or higher BMI. So I think we're learning more about this relationship between bacteria and inflammation and how this might increase or decrease our risk of expression of diabetes. And the other thing I do want to mention is our gut hormones. I don't have a slide on this, but many of our patients after a gastric bypass surgery, they might actually notice an immediate drop in their blood sugar levels, and even before they've lost the weight. And this is a different situation. What they'll see in their blood is that their gut hormone levels have radically increased as opposed to before surgery. So those gut hormones, the GLP-1, also are very important at helping to lower blood sugars. So the gut bacteria, gut hormones are working in collaboration to help prevent inflammation and disease. And so really encouraging our patients to eat those high-fiber meals. So high-fiber foods actually feed our good gut bacteria. And there's been some good studies looking at probiotics being used to help improve health of the gut bacteria, especially for kids who don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So on our website, on this page where I posted our handouts, I have a whole bunch of links for you that you can read and research more on this topic, because it's just fascinating how this gut bacteria and gut hormones interact with our disease expression. Let's move on now to type 1 diabetes. And what I'd like to ask all of you is, what stat best reflects the incidence currently of type 1 diabetes? Yeah, usually when we think about diabetes, we think about type 2 increasing, but type 1 is shifting also. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the polls. Thanks for voting, everybody. And I'll share your results with you. So, some of you said staying stable. Some of you said increasing in Scandinavian countries, which is absolutely true. But the correct answer is increasing by 20% over the past 10 years. So, as with type 2 diabetes, we're seeing a dramatic increase in type 1. And again, we're trying to ask this question, why? Does it have to do with the environment? Does it have to do with our intestines? What does it have to do with? So let's talk about that a little bit and see if we can figure this out. Because as it turns out, there is some commonalities perhaps between this increasing prevalence of type 1 and type 2. So you can see here the stats on type 1 diabetes. Many people every year are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and it's increasing by 3% annually worldwide, the rate. And I love this slide because it just shows the miracle of insulin. This is 1922 when so many of our children who had type 1 diabetes, were just struggling to live, waiting for something to help them get their blood sugars down. And in 1922, Banting and Best discovered insulin. And this little boy who has type 1 diabetes, makes no insulin whatsoever, made it up to Canada to the Banting and Best Museum. And after 2 months of insulin therapy, this is what this little boy looks like. So you can see when my patients tell me, I don't want to go on insulin, I hate insulin. I just think of this little boy and the miracle of insulin, that it helps us store fuel, store energy, and it helps move people back to health. And you can just see within 2 months of therapy what this did. So this is Dr. Banting, and he was born in Canada, and he did win the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1923 for his discovery. Along, he had collaborators also. But this is a really cool slide. I just found it on the internet a few months back, and it actually looks at the cell surface. And look at this. These yellow little Pac-Man-looking guys are insulin receptors. And these blue circles or spheres are insulin. So here's the blue circles, are insulin floating around, wanting to bind to the insulin receptor. And you can see many of the cell sites have, successfully bound insulin to them. And this then opens up the cell to let glucose be utilized for fuel. But if you have diabetes type 2, there's something broken, they call it post-receptor defects. You may have a lot of insulin receptors, but when insulin binds to it, it doesn't trigger the response it should to help utilize glucose. And of course, as you know, with type 1, no insulin is being made, so there would be no blue dots out there. But is that true? We'll talk about that. So here's a natural history of type 1 diabetes. And the average age for type 1 diabetes is the age of 14. And how does a kid get type 1 diabetes? Well, there has to be genetics somewhere along the line. And it can be from either parent or both parents. And so then you have that genetic risk for type 1 diabetes. But then there has to be a trigger. What are those triggers? Well, we're thinking most of the triggers are a stress situation, maybe a virus. A Coxsackie virus is a big one, or other viral triggers stress the body, and then the type 1 diabetes is expressed. Now, what happens over time, as you can see, this is beta cell functionality. It diminishes. And by the time the child has about 20% of beta cell function left, that's when the diabetes expresses itself. So as long as there's, even the pancreas at 50% function can do a pretty good job, but once it gets down to 20%, that's when we see the hyperglycemia. And how do we tell if somebody has type 1 diabetes? What's a confirming lab test that we have? Because we do rely a lot on clinical presentation, sudden weight loss, ketosis, family history. But if we're not sure, we can look at autoantibodies. And autoantibodies are present if the pancreas is under attack by the body. And I just want to point out some of the autoantibodies you might be familiar with or heard of. and the ones that we mostly draw in our clinical setting. So we'll look at the GAD, and we'll look at ICA and IAA. Those are the three most common ones we'll draw. ZNT8 is done in clinical studies. We don't see that very often. I've never seen it actually in a real life setting, but in clinical trials they use that test. But we'll look at the GAD, ICA, and IAA. And if those come back positive, we know that person has an autoimmune destruction of their pancreas. They have type 1 diabetes. And sometimes we'll notice that only one antibody is positive. So we know that person is walking toward type 1 diabetes. And actually, the researchers now have gotten so good at identifying who's at risk and looking at those autoantibodies, they have very excellent predictive models of who's going to get type 1 diabetes. So we're really in a really great space with type 1 as far as the research and really understanding the genetics and the pathophysiology involved. So let's talk a little bit more about type 1. By diagnosis, about 15 to 40% of beta cell function remains. So this is different than what we used to think. We used to think, you know, basically the pancreas is all done. But as it turns out, some people actually have 40% left at diagnosis. And the length of the honeymoon varies. And look at this. This is pretty shocking. And this is coming out from the new research. 10 to 15% of teens and adults still have clinically significant insulin production 5 years after diabetes onset. That's exciting. Why is that exciting? Because if you have any amount of beta cells left, even 10 or 15%, that helps prevent hypoglycemia, believe it or not. So if there's beta cells left, there's probably some alpha cells left, which release glucagon. So they have less low blood sugar and they have less high blood sugar. So we really, as diabetes educators and researchers, are in the business of beta cell protection. How do we protect the remaining beta cells? Because we want them to stay alive. And one of the best ways to protect beta cells is to get blood sugars down. And we'll talk about some other strategies the research is showing us. So for my type 2 patients, I'm always about beta cell protection. How can we keep your beta cells happy? But I think we're going to need to share that information with our patients with type 1 because many of them still have some remaining beta cells. And I'm going to tell you how they know this. They looked at it's called a Metalist study. They followed these people who've had diabetes type 1 for more than 50 years, and it was really remarkable that many of them had no eye disease or very little complications, even though they were diagnosed many, many years ago when we didn't really understand diabetes like we do now and our management strategies weren't as good. And so they did some studies on them, and after many, you know, after some of the participants died, they did autopsies, and they found that many of them still produce some insulin. So this is fascinating. How can we take this information and use it to help our patients with type 1 diabetes to see if they have some of those cells left, and how do we help them work their best and thrive? You'll notice some of your patients with type 1, they might call them brittle. Brittle is really not an accepted term, but patients that have a lot of fluctuations in their blood sugars. And after I heard of this study, I'm thinking those patients probably have really almost no beta cells left. But I've had other patients with type 1 diabetes who really don't have those wild glucose excursions and remarkably seem to handle low blood sugars. Maybe they have. Maybe they're the ones with that 10% left. So here's a picture of a beta cell. It's a good-looking cell, and they serve one well while they last, even if on supplemental insulin. We want to prevent these beta cells from dying off as much as we can, and so that's why we talk about preventing that hyperglycemia. Let's just talk a little bit about the most recent research on type 1 diabetes. And if you don't work with type 1 that much, that's okay, because as this population of people with type 1 increases, we're going to see them more and more coming through our doors. So making sure we know this information to share with them and their families is so critical. So let's just talk a little bit about primary. We talked about pathophysiology. Let's look at primary prevention. And what triggers type 1, and can we actually make a difference in preventing that onset of type 1? You have the genes. Can we stop the genes from turning on to initiate that destruction of the beta cells? So what they're doing right now, primary prevention means let's find those at risk of type 1 and see if early intervention to protect the beta cells prevents or delays onset. And now, as I've mentioned, we have really good genetic screening techniques we can use to find those at risk. And then we can maybe take action. 1 million people currently in the United States are at risk, and many of them don't know how to get help, so we'll talk about that. So the TEDDY study is saying, hey, let's see if we can figure out what environmental determinants increase the risk of type 1 diabetes. So they're looking at all these different things. So if you have the genetic risk for type 1, what environmental trigger might increase or decrease your risk? And they're looking at cow's milk, exposure to gluten, adequate vitamin D, nitrate exposure, so all those hot dogs, processed foods, processed meats with nitrates, they're not looking that good for the general health of the population. So if I'm working with families of type 1, I'm going to talk about, you know, if you're going to have children or if you have young children, maybe these are some things you might want to consider. So the one thing we do know from an early study out of Finland, so Finland's doing a lot of great work on prevention of type 1 because they have a very high prevalence. The Scandinavian countries are really being hit hard by it, is that they found that avoiding cow's milk formula in the first 6 months of life had a significant impact in decreasing the expression of type 1 diabetes later on. So this is a Findia pilot study. We know that cow's milk-based formula can trigger an autoimmune response to the person's pancreas. And so as we get more data, we can start informing people. And I would say right now, if I knew somebody with type 1 in their family and they were going to have kids, I would say avoid cow's milk-based formula or cow's milk for the first 6 months. I mean, it's pretty strong data that we should do that and try to breastfeed as long as you can. So TEDDY is a 20-year study. We don't have the results yet. As far as the environmental triggers that are looking to contribute to type 1 diabetes, but definitely the researchers now are saying we actually know how to identify who's at risk, and they're even talking about a public health model to screen type 1 risk in the general population. So it would be expensive right now, but Dr. Hagopian and his colleagues think that this might be something we want to pursue in the future, screening for people at risk for type 1. The other thing I do want to talk about is a hygiene hypothesis. And this actually kind of gets back to our gut bacteria in that in studies, mice raised in clean environments had a higher risk for diabetes than those raised in a dirty one. And actually, if you look at kids and their risk of disease later in life, asthma and diabetes and autoimmune diseases, kids who are raised on farms with animals, who get out in the dirt, and who would play with other kids in more rural settings have less risk of these autoimmune diseases. As a matter of fact, if you think about, you know, Mexico and India, where the people are living in close quarters, maybe don't have access to all the resources that other populations do, they have a lot less type 1 diabetes. So it's interesting to think about how the environment can influence disease. And in America, actually, it just seems like we've gotten very sanitarily focused. Like there's, you know, gels and soaps and bleaching, and yeah, we're killing the bad bacteria, but we're also killing a lot of those good bacteria. So it just causes us to pause and think, you know, what are we changing in our environment that's increasing our risk of type 1 and type 2 diabetes and obesity? Are these somehow interrelated? Are we changing our environment so much that it's changing our gut bacteria and our diversity, and that's influencing our expression of disease? And certainly in Finland, they did a great study looking at kids who got type 1 diabetes, and right before they expressed their type 1 diabetes, they saw a huge shift in their gut bacteria. And so we know that there's a relationship between gut bacteria and disease expression. So what's my take-home message? Get dirty. Breastfeed if possible. I know all women can breastfeed, so I totally acknowledge and hear that. But if they can breastfeed, even for the first 6 months, terrific. Avoid early exposure to cow's milk and keep an eye on new research and results. And what I would want to mention here is a Finnish team making a breakthrough, perhaps a diabetes vaccine. So this is for type 1 diabetes. As I mentioned before, on the Coxsackie B virus exposure to that can increase the risk of type 1 expression. And so they actually have developed a vaccine to Coxsackie. And there's 7 different variations of the Coxsackie virus. It says 6 here. I read 6 and 7. So maybe if we give kids at risk for type 1 diabetes this vaccine, it could prevent them from expressing type 1 during their lifetime. I don't know. It's exciting, really exciting. So I want to ask you one more poll question. How hopeful are you about finding a cure for type 1 diabetes during our lifetime? Yeah, thank you so much for voting, everybody. You know what? It takes a lot of research dollars to fund all this research that's going on, and that's always the biggest barrier, is getting enough monies to do the research. I'm going to go ahead and close this. Thank you so much, everybody. But I think the JDRF and other organizations and the CDC and the NIH have really seen that they're making remarkable progress in type 1 prevention and treatment. So I'm hoping that we'll see during our lifetime. I want to say I'm pretty hopeful that we'll see maybe a vaccine or a strategy to prevent type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, in a way, is less complex than type 2. So I feel pretty hopeful about finding out strategies to prevent it. I want to also just mention TrialNet. TrialNet is for people who have family members with type 1 diabetes. It's a free resource. And if you know somebody who has a family member with type 1 diabetes, let them know about this website, because there's 2 different aspects to this study. One is a natural history of type 1 diabetes, and so that they would enroll in this study and they would get their antibodies tested. If they qualify, they get their antibodies tested so they can see, do they have positive, you know, the GAD, ICA, and IAA. And if they do, then they can enter natural history where they're just observed, or they could actually enter the study where they provide an intervention, and maybe they could slow the progression of type 1 diabetes. And I have had many colleagues and friends who have children in this study, and it's really making a difference in their lives. There's an oral insulin. So oral insulin, if you have the positive autoantibody, they give you this oral insulin. And it seems to delay the onset of diabetes by 4 years, maybe even longer. We're starting earlier now. So if you can delay it by 4 years, protect those beta cells, it's terrific. And there's another study they're doing that is a CD3 monoclonal antibody, teplizumab. And what they're doing is providing this to participants with new onset type 1. And what they found out is that half of the participants who enrolled in this study and were maintained on this medication maintained insulin production. So this is a very early result, but I think it's exciting. If we can find out who's already moving toward type 1 diabetes, they have positive autoantibodies, and we start them on this CD3 medication, maybe we can protect their beta cells. And just to finally wrap up, living with diabetes can be really tough. And we really encourage our patients, of course, to get active and keep their mind and body healthy, exercising, you know, getting social. We know that the more social outlets you have, the more you connect with people, people tend to do a lot better with chronic diseases. And yoga and mindfulness. And you've heard probably a lot about mindfulness, and you might say, what does that mean exactly? And I wanted to share with you a terrific website. And on this website, actionforhappiness.org, they give you concrete strategies that you can take in your life and your patients can take in their life to have a happier life. There is scientific research that shows things that people can actually do to feel better, to live better, and to have less depression. And on the Action for Happiness website, here is kind of the summary of different things people can do to feel better. And actually, in my diabetes classes, there's a little workbook you can find on this website. I give it out to them on week 3, and I have them come back and tell me, you know, and share with each other what brings you happiness. And when they share that, it's really amazing that nobody talks about my Mercedes or my big house or my swimming pool or my, you know, 10-carat diamond ring. They always talk about being with others, my family, you know, and things that are very meaningful. So to really tap into that with people and help them identify what brings them happiness can really help them through some of those hard times and hard days living with diabetes. So to kind of wrap up, and I will stay for future questions and we'll have a dialogue, but as diabetes educators and health professionals, I just want to really say, make a call out to each one of you that we provide counseling and one-on-one education to our patients, and then we also have a wonderful opportunity, given our background and our clinical knowledge, to reach out to our communities, to our legislation, and to speak up about public health issues. Because I believe, just like Margaret Mead, that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can make big changes in the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. So thank you so much for joining us. And just to remind you, that is our gesture of thanks to you. We have a great sale going on in our online courses. $169 for our deluxe bundle. Just use the coupon code ALMOND and your discount will be applied. And the other thing I want to mention is I do travel the country and I talk about diabetes. I have a one-day course and I have a lot of different topics I love to present on. So if you think you would like to have me present at your facility, at your hospital, I would love an invitation. You can just contact me at diabetesed.net and let me know what topics you're interested in and we can get going. That would be terrific. If you have any further questions, you can email us, bev@diabetesed.net, or visit our website. And I want to thank all of you again for taking the time out of your very busy day and joining us. And now I'm going to stop the recording and answer your questions. So thank you.